Thank you very much. Well, thanks for Catherine, thanks for Jan, thanks for Kasia for the drive. Thank you for the organizers and everybody. Just before that, just to make sure that I'm really, I asked before Catherine and Jane, but how many of those of the people here are from a mathematical background? Okay, how many from a clinical or biological background? Okay, so clearly mostly mathematical. And how many of those are familiar with the 95 HIV model? Perelson and me and others. And the 98 model on Hep C? Less. Okay, so I'll start with the 98 model, exactly what we want. Good. You're right. And as Catherine said, I do believe that simple models, not always easy, but simple models can give us a lot. But I don't like usually to use this phrase, the take-home message, but I'll do it anyway. The take-home message from the talk, I hope, today is that it's not always true that simple models are the best. The point is, and that's I hope what I'm going to be able to show you, is you have to find the right level of simplicity or complexity in the modeling for the data you have and for the problem you're asking yourself, the question you're asking yourself. So what I'm going to do is kind of first an historical survey, but also a survey of different difficulties or different levels of modeling. And I'm going to hopefully get to three levels of modeling, maybe just two. We'll see how the time works out. I'll start with the 98 model, which is relatively simple, and then move on to more complicated models. So we're talking about the same things. The 95, I'm just going to show in two or three slides, so we talk about the same things. In the 95 paper, we have shown that HSV replicates very rapidly, about 10 to the 11, 10 to 12 variants per day. One of the implications from that was that we have to treat the HIV infection as soon as possible, not to wait until the virus starts to grow. And the second implication was that with the mutation rate that HIV has, and Hep C, by the way, the same more or less, and with this kind of production rate, if you make the combinatorics, and it's not so difficult, you can see that all single and double mutations exist every day in every patient, and therefore, because you have some kind of a quasi-species cloud of the virus, the treatment you give, what we call an HIV heart, has to be such that you need three mutations in order to create resistance. That the virus needs three mutations in order to create resistance. If the virus needs three mutations, it's not going to be able to get away from such a treatment. If you give a treatment like what we used to give in the beginning, a monotherapy, where there's only one mutation needed, the virus, of course, goes away in a second. And here you see the data from the 95 paper. There's about 10 patients here. You can see all of them going down in a week. And then what happens is, because you have in the beginning this steady state, the wild type is predominant. And that's important to make a point here. What I call the wild type here is by definition the predominant. So it's kind of a closed circular definition here. The dominant virus is what we call the wild type, and vice versa. That's how we do this. But because, as I said, there's such a big production rate and mutation rate, the wild type virus, the space of one to three mutations around that wild type virus is all the time searched. So in the moment that you give a monotherapy here, in this case we gave a protease inhibitor, ritonavir, within very short time, and in the case of HIV we talk about 2 to 3 weeks, the virus finds its way, or actually the new virus is selected, the resistant virus, which was before not the dominant one but had very low levels, is selected, and the virus goes up again and rebounds. And this happens every time in HIV. So if you give monotherapy and if you have a resistant virus that comes up, you always have a rebound. And that's what we're going to try now to see in Hep C. I hope to get to that at the end of the talk. How in Hep C this might be not correct, and actually we might have some kind of a paradigm shift here, that not every time you have a resistant virus, there's necessarily a failure of the treatment. Not every time that there's resistant virus, the viral level goes back to a steady state. I'm just going to say it in the beginning, so in case I don't get to that slide in the end, most of the work, or large part of the work here, was done with a postdoc of mine, Jeremy Gedge, who is now a postdoc with Anand Perelson, and with Tali Olchek, who at the time was a master's student, now she's a PhD student. Maybe before that, actually, how many people here know about hepatitis C? Should I give a short introduction about hepatitis C? Yeah, okay. So hepatitis C is a very bad news for us in terms of public health. Actually, many people call it the silent epidemic because many people don't know about it enough. The reason many people don't know about it enough, by the way, is because the government and the public health organizations don't make a lot of effort to test for that and to make enough awareness of in the public about this virus, and in a moment you're going to understand why. It's a big problem because about 2% of the population all over the world, not only in Africa like in HIV mostly, but including in our countries, in Western countries, in Asia, in some countries actually much more than 2%, are infected, chronically infected with the virus. So we're talking about a virus that is much, much, much more dominant than HIV. About, I would say, a quarter of the patients chronically infected with HIV will develop liver failure over the time, starting with fibrosis, going into cirrhosis, and the liver at some point is going to stop functioning. In a certain percent of the patients, there is also liver cancer that develops. So if you make the calculation very rapidly, about a quarter of the patients, and this happens, by the way, over variable time, anything between 10 years usually up to 20 or 30 years. It's not a very rapid disease. That's what we are lucky. So if you make calculation 2% and a quarter, you talk about 0.5% of the population that's going to have major liver problems within the next 10 years. The peak, by the way, is arriving very soon because since 90 or something, the number of infected people have gone down. By the way, the virus goes mostly by blood-to-blood infection, so no sexual, or almost no sexual interactions can give rise to infection unless there's blood-to-blood contact. So since we started, the virus was found only in 1992. Since we've found the virus, and in 94 more or less, we started to screen the blood banks for that. Since then, the infection has gone down in a major way. So if you make the calculation, in about 5 years, it's going to be the peak of the people who would have need liver transplantations. The problem is that we don't have any artificial livers. Liver transplantation, as you probably know, are very difficult, also very expensive. There are not many livers also. We just started doing live liver transplantation, so taking people from donors, liver from donors, half the liver, you take half the liver from a donor. The liver grows very fast, by the way, it can grow very fast, so it grows back to normal size. But most of liver transplantation are still from people who died. So this is a big problem. So what we would like, of course, is to have a good treatment. That would be nice if we have a good treatment of such a disease that has such a big public health problem. But even the treatment that we have over the last 8 years, which is already new, only gives cure, what we call SVR, or sustained viral response, only gives that in about a little less than half of the people, 40%, I would say. And that's a problem. Now, this new treatment is a combination of two drugs, interferon alpha, which is a cytokine produced by the body, but this interferon alpha is given exogenously. Actually, it's called it's a pegylated interferon alpha, so it's interferon alpha conjugated with a PEG molecule. I'm not going to go too much into it, but unless I'm going to talk about it, this is the pharmacokinetic part. But the PEG, what it does, it allows you the interferon to stay, to be released into the body in circulation slower and to get cleared from the body slower. So basically, we would hope the PEG would keep the interferon levels up the whole time from one injection to the next. The injections are given in a weekly basis. And then, in addition, you also have to take another drug, which is called ribavirin. Both drugs, at the time, we didn't know how they work. PEG, interferon, we know already how it works. Actually, this is what I'm going to start with. That's our work from 98. That's the historical part. Ribavirin, by the way, it's still a challenge. If anyone wants to work on that, we're still not 100% sure how ribavirin works. Now, you give those two drugs for 1 year, and only for 1 year, and after 1 year, the virus should be cleared from the body, or at least it's undetectable in the body because it went down to very low levels, and then you stop to give this treatment. And if you're lucky, if the patient is lucky, the virus doesn't come back. And that's what we call sustained viral response. So you give the treatment for 1 year, and after 1 year, the virus doesn't come back, and you have a sustained viral response. In many cases, the virus relapses after the treatment. So it means that the virus was just in very low levels, but it was still there. We couldn't detect it, but it was still there. And that happens in many cases. And in some cases, the virus doesn't get cleared up at all. So the treatment doesn't work at all. So to add to all of that problem is that this treatment is really, really, really bad. And that's why you can only give it for 1 year. First, it's expensive. That's one problem. For the public health organization, that's a big problem. It's like heart. It's $10,000 or more a year. But more important, it's terrible from point of view of quality of life and clinical impact side effects. Interferon alpha basically takes care of your white blood cells, lymphocytes, and neutrophils. So you have lymphopenia and neutropenia. They go down to very low levels. And ribavirin takes care of the red blood cells, so you have anemia. So when you have this treatment for 1 year, all your blood cells basically go down to very low levels. People report that they have the worst flu-like symptoms they ever had for the whole year. So think being with the worst flu you ever had a whole year like this. Suicidal attempts and more. So it's really something you're not happy to do. With only 40% success, what you really would like to do is to be able to know how that drug works, and then to be able to somehow treat the patients accordingly and modify the treatment accordingly and predict which patients are going to have a good result and which not. Unfortunately, at the time, as I said, we didn't know how those two drugs are working. Part of the problem is that until today, at the time, we didn't have any viral culture in vitro. Now we have a partial culture in vitro. And no simple animal model. The only animal model we have, the only animal we can work with hep C is chimpanzees. And chimpanzees, you can do less work, actually, than you can do with humans. You can do experiments on humans. We do experiments on humans. It's not nice to say, but that's the truth. We do experiments on humans that we cannot do on chimpanzees. The movement for the right of humans is not as strong as the movement for the right of animals. Actually, the reason, as the clinician said, is very practical. The reason for that, a chimpanzee cannot sign the letter of consent. So that's why. Joke aside, it's almost impossible to do experiments on chimpanzees nowadays. Almost impossible. So we really have no animal models. We today work with a partial mice model, but it's complicated. Okay, so what you have to do is study the therapy effect with mathematical models. As I said, I started with HIV. In red, you have your viral kinetics of an individual treated with heart, in this time already a cocktail, in HIV patient. And you can see that before the treatment, there's a steady state, as I said. And after the treatment, there's a decline, as we saw before, of about a log and a half, 2 logs within a week. In green, on the other hand, you have a patient infected with hepatitis C and treated, in this case, with interferon. And what you can see, which is interesting, is that the kinetics of hepatitis C are very different. You have a very rapid decline already in the first day, and then a slower decline that ensues after the first day. And what we would like to know is, can we use this kinetics in order to understand the drug work, how the mechanism is, and how can we have any impact on making the treatment better? This is what happens when you see the viral kinetics over 2 weeks with three different doses of interferon. Actually, in this case, it's injections, normal injections of interferon, not pegylated, and they're given daily in this case. And you can see this first phase here, and you can see there's a dose response. So the higher the dose, 10 and 15, the better the first phase response. And then there's a second phase response going on with a little less dose response than the first paper. So this was the model, the very simple model we used for HIV at the time, and then we had made this model more and more complicated. I'm going to leave now HIV, and I'm going to move to hepatitis C. So we using the model that Jane spoke before in the course, we're using this very simple model, and that's the first basic model that we can use for any viral dynamics. where we have the virus. The virus can infect the target cells. Target cells become infected cells, and infected cells make virus. And this is translated into the three differential equations that Jane have shown you before. I'm not going to go into the equations right now anymore. I want to make a point here that the infected cells here are used as a black box. And when we say that cells are infected, the whole infection process actually is a very complicated biological process that involves many, many, many biological players there. So for us, it's just one term in the model, a mathematical term in the model, but actually there is a lot, a whole world there. And when we say that virus is produced by infected cells, that's even worse, because there's a whole viral replication going within the cell, which is a whole machinery, a whole biological world by itself. So this is really a big simplification. It's better than the one equation model we had before, but it's still a big simplification, and we have to remember that. I'm going to jump that. But I still want to have get a little feeling from that model in order for us to understand later the next more complicated model. So when we think what is the drug mechanism, how can the drug work against the virus in this simple model, we can think of two possible mechanisms. One is blocking the novel infection, and one is blocking the production. Again, when I'm saying mechanisms here, I'm saying mechanism very grosso modo, because as I said, infection by itself is the whole thing, and production is the whole thing. But we could say that either we're blocking this, or we're blocking this, and we know examples for both of those possibilities from other viruses. And we did not know what interferon does for Hep C. The paradigm at the time, actually, in 98, was interferon blocks infection, because we know that that's what interferon does in many viruses, and it's true. By the way, that's what interferon does also for HIV. We found it out afterwards. So usually people think of interferon as blocking infection, and that was what was the paradigm at the time. The question is it correct or not? So in terms of the schematic model, that's how it looks. Either we block this process or we block this process. And I want to give here this joke. Whoever heard this joke already, I know that I keep saying this joke a few times. I'm sure many of you heard it, but those who did not, I think it's an important joke. This mathematical biologist guy is walking somewhere, I don't know, in Canada or wherever, and he's in vacation, and he falls upon this herd of sheep, and he remembers that he doesn't have any meat at home to grill. So he goes to the shepherd, and he tells the shepherd, "Hey, if I can count all your sheep in just 2 seconds, can I get one of them?" And the shepherd knows he has many, many sheep. It's not possible to count all of them in just 2 seconds. So he says, "Yes, of course, it's a bet." So they go, they shake hands, and the guy looks around and says, "You have 123 sheep." And the shepherd is a really good shepherd. He knows exactly how many sheep he has in every moment, so it's true. He knows he has 123. He doesn't understand how the guy was able to count in 2 seconds 123 sheep, but okay, a bet is a bet, so go and take one. So the guy goes, takes one of the animals, and starts going away. And the shepherd calls after him and says, "Hey, if I tell you your profession, will you give me back my animal?" And the guy says, "Of course, how can he know what I'm working on?" So they bet again, and the shepherd tells him, "You're a mathematical biologist." And the guy is totally shocked, "How did you know?" And says, "Well, first, clearly you know how to count, so you should be good in mathematics. And second, if you give me back my dog, I'll tell you." So, as mathematical biologists, we are many times criticized by the fact that we don't know the difference between sheep and dogs. And whoever was at the dim sum restaurant today, you can understand how important it is. I was in China some years ago, and you should really know the difference between sheep and dogs when you're eating. But in terms of modeling, for mathematical biologists, it's very important not only to know the mathematics, but also to know the biology, as I meant. And therefore, when we're doing this kind of modeling, and I keep repeating it, and that's why I think the joke is so important, we have to remember, keep in mind, that although in this case we are mixing sheep and dogs, because as I said, each of those terms is a very grosso modo, at some point you don't have any other way. At some point it's important to mix sheep and dogs, because if not, you don't get out of it. And you still can get interesting results, but you have to remember that you're mixing sheep and dogs, and you have to write in the paper that you're mixing sheep and dogs and make the what are the implications from that. And then you're okay. Then nobody can tell you that you're doing it wrong. So anyway, so this is the three equations that Jane spoke about quite extensively in the morning. You have equation for target cells. This is the natural target cell dynamics. Cells get infected. Infected cells die with a rate delta, which could be or not faster than the death rate D of the target cells, the non-infected cells. And then the infected cells make variants. And for hepatitis C, the variants just bud slowly from the cells. Hepatitis C doesn't kill the cells. There's no burst of viruses. So we have a continuous production. We've tried also other possibilities. And then the drug effect here either comes in blocking infection with the parameter eta or the parameter epsilon. So eta and epsilon can be anything between 0 and 1. If they're 0, of course, then 1 minus 0 doesn't do anything. If they're 1, let's say you block production, 1 minus 1, you have no production at all. And then you have just a exponential, single exponential decline with clearance rate, which would be great if we could achieve that. We never achieve that. So we never block 100%. Let's say block 90%, 99%, etc. And the same thing you can do for blocking infection. And then in this case, you have to count the sheep correctly. It's true that the model is very simple, but it's still nonlinear. So if we try to solve the model this way, it's not possible to solve the model. We make a few normal approximations. First, we assume the target cells are in quasi-steady state. So the target cells equation we take away and we take have instead of that a constant here. We can do some other approximation instead. It also works that I plus T is equal a constant. And then we assume a steady state pretreatment, which we know is the case in hepatitis C and in HIV. So it's okay. By the way, in hepatitis B, that's not the case. So hepatitis B, CMV, influenza, etc. You have to be careful with this assumption. If you make those assumptions, then you can solve the model. You get two exponentials equation that is pretty simple. And if lambda and delta, if the clearance rate of the virus and the death rate or loss rate of the infected cells are different enough from each other, usually the clearance rate of the virus is faster, then you can say that one of the exponential is the clearance rate and that one exponential is the death rate, loss rate of the virus, and things become simple. And we end up with only 4 parameters out of 9 we began with. So that's also very important. So you don't have to fit 9 parameters. You can fit only 4 parameters. That's very important. So the two clearance rates and epsilon and eta. Then when you do this and you simulate blocking infection and blocking production, you can see that simulating blocking infection gives you only one single phase decline, while blocking production gives you this biphase decline. And moreover, when you block production, you get this nice dose response or effectiveness response. For epsilon 80, 95, 99, you get different first phase declines, and then you get a second phase after that. Of course, if you block 100%, as I said, you have a single exponential decline. On the other hand, when you block infection, the dose response is very limited, and you only have a shoulder, one single phase decline. And as I mentioned before, in the empirical data, we see a biphasic decline. So clearly, the blocking infection cannot explain this kind of a data. Let us just understand this for a moment, because I would come back to that later. Before treatment, we have steady state, as I said, with a viral load level that is more or less V naught. And for that to happen, of course, we need equilibrium on the virus production versus the virus clearance. But we also need equilibrium in the amount of how many cells are infected every day and how many cells are lost. So if you have equilibrium on both terms, then we get the steady state. So now let's do a thought experiment. Let's assume that there's a drug that blocks 100% of infection, but on the same time, this drug doesn't allow the cells to die, the infected cells to die. So what is going to happen once you give the drug? Any guesses? How many people say the virus load is going to go down? No one. How many people say the virus load is going to go up? Stay the same? Say nothing. I guess most people say nothing. 100%. Right. What's going to happen to viral loads? Just going to stay the same. Exactly. It's just going to stay the same because we're not blocking production, so each cell is making the same amount of virus. You have no change in the number of infected cells, so the viral load is just going to stay the same. Now, of course, that's just a thought experiment because cells don't live forever. Cells, of course, are lost, and therefore the virus level is going to go declining, but they're going to decline with the loss rate of the cells, not of the virus. So when you see the viral decline in HIV, actually, because in HIV, all the treatments, including protease inhibitors, don't get confused, all the treatments we have until now in HIV, and if anyone knows of a drug that blocks production in HIV, I would really be happy to know about it. All the drugs in HIV block infection, and therefore all the declines we're seeing in HIV are also actually declines that are based on the half-life of the infected cells. And we might have a few different declines, slopes, but they're all based on different half-lives of different infected cell populations. Now, on the other hand, if you block production, let's say by 90%, then you're going to have a rapid decline. And this rapid decline now depends on the clearance rate of the free virus, because what happens is you have the same amount of cells, still let's say that they don't die for the moment. You have the same amount of cells, but instead of making 100% of the virus like before, they're now only doing 10%. The move from 10% level to from 100% to 10% level now is just created by the clearance of free virus. So that's why now the slope is going to depend on the clearance of the free virus. And then you're going to move to a new steady state that can tell you exactly what is the effectiveness of your drug, because it's going to be just Y minus epsilon viral V-naught. Of course, again, cells don't live forever, and that's why you get the biphasic decline. The first phase is just the shift from 100% to a partial percent of production with a clearance rate of the virus. The second slope tells you about how fast are the cells dying. So that's very important, because you're able to, using biphasic decline, if you block production, you're able to separate two different biological processes that are happening in the same time. And that's cute. That's nice. Okay, so when we do this, now we understand why blocking infection doesn't give us biphasic decline. And it's interesting to see that blocking production does give us that. And in fact, when we go and fit the patient data with this model, we get very nice results. And we are able to first came up with the hypothesis that interferon actually in hepatitis C blocks production and not infection. And this prediction was a few years after proved in vitro. So that was really nice that this mathematical prediction was proved. And second, we were able to use this kind of viral kinetics to predict the results of treatment, as you're going to see in a moment. Before that, I just want to make one point, and that's an important point for those of you who are students. The other ones, I'm sure, know about it and work this way. But for the students among us, one thing I always want to tell, when you're working with clinicians and experimentalists, et cetera, it's very important that you tell them what you can do with the mass. And it's very important that you also tell them what you cannot do. And what we can do with the math here is that we can say that blocking production is a necessary assumption. So interferon has to block production of HIV, because if not, we cannot explain the data. What we cannot say is if interferon blocks infection or not. Because if you see the green and the yellow lines here, the green lines are blocking production at different rates with no blocking infection at all. And the yellow lines are blocking the same production but with 100% blocking infection as well. And if anyone can tell me that if you have two lines like this and you have clinical data from the patients, you are able to distinguish if you are blocking infection 0% or 100%, I would say that your paper is not worth it. So the message here is interferon has to block production, but maybe it's blocking infection, maybe not. And we cannot know, at least not from this level of modeling, if we're blocking infection or not. So it's also important sometimes to tell what we cannot say or not. I'm going to skip a little just to come up to some clinical conclusion we had here. So one thing that was nice was that once we took and started to look into the second phase slope, and in the y-axis here you have the second phase slope, the lower ones in negative are the faster ones. We started seeing something that was very interesting. Second phase slope was very different from one patient to another, very different. And so in the beginning, we were very much disappointed, because the HIV work in the beginning was very nice, and that's why I started, because all the slopes were the same. And because all the slopes were the same, we thought, okay, there's a universal parameter here, something here is biologically conserved, so something is correct here. And then when we started doing the hepatitis C work, we suddenly saw that the second phase slope is all over the place. Some patients are flat, and some patients are very rapid, 0.4 per day, which is more or less a log base 10 per week. If you talk with clinicians, it's much easier to talk about log 10 per week. So it's a big difference. Some of them are going 10 times a week, and some of them are just flat. And we were very disappointed when we saw that in the beginning. Actually, the person who saw the interesting part about that was the chief science office of the company who was sponsoring us at the time. And she came and told us at the time that she would stop our funding, that she's not going to not stop our funding, but she's not going to renew our funding after that. And we were very disappointed. We didn't understand why. And she told us, well, the results are against our company's strategy. And we didn't understand that. And only afterwards we started understanding, about 2 or 3 weeks later. And when we started looking at the patients who had sustained response to the treatment, all the patients on the right of the black vertical line, and the patients who failed treatment. And what we saw is all the patients who have a slow decline in the first 2 weeks, you can calculate already that they have a slow second phase decline, none of them had a sustained viral response. So we have 100% negative predictive value in that study. So basically, already after 2 weeks, you can predict, not with 100%, in this case it was 100%, but in general we get about 98%, which is clinically good enough, you can predict which patients are going to fail treatment. Now, the company at the time wanted to sell the drug as much as possible and continue the drug in as much as many possible patients. That company, by the way, today is not, then they were the leading company, today they're not the leading company, so it's not good to be a greedy company. And the company that did sponsor us afterwards became the leading company. So, no, I'm not joking, really. The other company just understood that if you use this idea, instead of going against it, you use this idea and you go to the patients and you tell them, I can tell you after 2 weeks if you're going to be able to succeed the treatment, very difficult treatment of 1 year or not, or if, unfortunately, I'm going to tell you after 2 weeks, I'm sorry, you only have 1 or 2% chance after 1 year of this difficult treatment to get anything out of it. They understood that it's actually better for, the patients, but also for them, because more patients are going to get treated then. Because, as I said, it's a very difficult drug treatment, and the hepatitis C works for many years, so many patients don't get treated. But they're able to treat many more patients, because, of course, if a patient knows if it's going to get a good result from the treatment or not, he's much more inclined to do that. This became, and I'm going to show you later a little, this became the standard, clinical standard nowadays for treatment of hepatitis C, and not the slope, actually the slope is too complicated and you need too many samples to calculate the slope, but what we call rapid viral response. So if you have a decline below a certain level, undetectable level actually, at 4 weeks or not, became kind of the gold standard to continue treatment or not, and this is a clinical practice nowadays, totally clinical practice. Actually, we're trying to get it better and better. So as I said, the first phase depends on the clearance of the free virus. The second phase depends on the loss rate of an infected cells. And I just have to make here a small precision point that it depends on the loss rate of infected cells, but it also depends a little on the effectiveness of the drug. Because, of course, if the drug is 100% effective, well, not 100%, but close to 100%, then the slope is going to be very similar to delta, to the loss rate of infected cell. But if the drug is not blocking the virus production, then the virus production is going to mask your slope. So the slope is going to get slower and slower. If the drug is really not working well, you're just going to get a flat slope, even if delta is high, because you're not just blocking enough production. But the important thing here is that epsilon on the second slope is linear effect. So if epsilon is 90% or 99%, it's going to be only 10% effect on the slope. If you have epsilon is 99 versus 99.9, it's going to be only 1% effect on the slope. On the first phase, the drug, if you remember, works, effectiveness works on the exponential way. So 90% is 1 log, 99% is 2 logs, 99.9 is 3 logs. So you can clearly see the difference. I'm going to skip, I think, the pharmacokinetics for the moment. If I have time later, I'm going to get back to that later. But just to make the point, just to maybe open the appetite for that, as I said, we assume, in this case, we assume that first all the other parameters are kept constant, which is something we ask ourselves before and after treatment. and that, more important, effectiveness of the treatment is constant throughout the treatment. When you give daily drug, it's probably correct, but giving the drug, the injection daily, is impossible. Patients are not able to do it, at least not in the U.S. In Germany, they do it quite well. But instead of that, we came up with this pegylated interferon. And one of the questions we had with the pegylated interferon, is it really doing what it should be doing? I mean, is it really working as good as keeping the drug levels constant all the time? And actually, I didn't remember there's this joke here, but if it's already there, then I'll show that. I was invited by one of the companies, there are two companies that make pegylated interferon, alpha-2A and alpha-2B, to give a talk, and actually asked me to talk about the difference between the two drugs. And I felt a little awkward about it. So instead of talking about the difference between the drug, I said, okay, I'm going to talk about difference in instead of viral kinetics, viral kinetics in dating dynamics between women and men. And when you think about the involvement levels, so switch for a moment, we're moving to the zombies modeling for the moment, so now it's dating modeling. So if you think about dating dynamics and how much the involvement level changes or increases with time, usually if it depends on the man, the involvement level is going to go up very fast. If it depends on women, it's going to go usually slower, but more importantly, women are much more complex creatures than men. Men are very simple creatures. So every woman is going to be a little different. So you have a lot of variability here in the increased rates with the women. On the other hand, after a certain peak level, men tend to have a decline in the involvement quite rapidly. While with women, again, it changes. Some women actually start to go up after that. Some of them decline a little, etc. So there's big gender effect here. Over this short dynamics. But on the long-term dynamics, in order to get a sustained vital relationship versus no relationship, what's really important is not the difference between men and women, or at least I believe so romantically, but in the personality correlates or the interaction between the each couple. So in that case, the gender effects are not important anymore. And of course, if you switch the both to the vertical axis to the other side, and you change the pegylated interferon alpha to A and alpha to B, what we see here, and I'm not going to go at the moment to the mathematics, but I just wanted to mention that, what we see here is that there's complex viral kinetics within every week from one injection to the next, because the drug levels are not constant. The drug levels go up and then go down, and actually there's differences between the two pegylated interferons. Each of them is different for different reasons. I'm not going to go into that one. So every week there's very complicated dynamics going on, and these dynamics actually continue every injection again and again and again. But when you look at the general long-term decline, which is the second phase decline, it doesn't depend anymore on the drug. It depends really on the viral host correlates. And what we show, as I said before, if you have less than 0.3 logs per week, you basically have no chance for treatment. So if I have time at the end, I'm going to go back to explain this, but I have a feeling I'm not going to have time for that. And so the last thing related to this part is that, as I mentioned before, I'm not going to go into all details because it's a more clinical point, but we are able now, within 2 to 4 weeks, to predict correctly 70% of the patients what is going to be the response. So within 2 to 4 weeks, we can tell about 40 or 50% of the patients that they're going to have 80% or 90% or 95% chance for sustained response. About 10%, a little more than 10% of the patients, we're able to tell them, sorry, you have almost 0% for sustained response. This is already within 2 to 4 weeks. Both things are important. I told you it's very important to tell patients, of course, not to continue treatment. I think it's clear for everybody if it's not going to work. It's also very important to tell patients they have 95% chance. Because when you go into the treatment, you know you have 40% chance. That doesn't sound very good. Treatment is hard. You start having symptoms, you start feeling bad. What do? Stop taking it. We're all people. We know what we do when we don't feel good with the drug we take. But if somebody tells you, hey, you have 95% chance for sustained response, if you continue taking the treatment seriously, you're going to do it much better. So that's why also positive predictive values are very important, not only negative predictive value. Unfortunately, the yellow group here, about a third of the patients, we have to wait for 12 weeks. So only after 12 weeks we can tell the patients if they have a good chance or not good chance. But 66% of the patients we can tell them quite early on. Okay, so that was the situation until now. And very luckily, in the last few years, after many, many, many years, actually since I'm in the field, that companies are trying to make direct antivirals, we are starting to have a few drugs that are working directly against the virus. Because if I didn't mention before, interferon, of course, is just a cytokine. It doesn't work directly against the virus. And ribavirin also doesn't work against the virus directly. And we wanted to have a drug like we have for hepatitis B, for HIV, for CMV, for influenza, for like all the viruses, not all, but many of the viruses. We have drugs that work directly against them, blocking some of the enzymes, inhibiting the enzymes. And for hepatitis C, we're not able to do this. Until the last few years, the first two drugs, two protease inhibitors, are in phase 3 and expected to go into the clinical use hopefully in a year from now. So we're finally in that situation. And the question is, what can we learn from what can we do with this new data, with the new drugs, and is it the same situation or not? What's going to change in this new generation of hepatitis C treatment? So as we look in some of the early data, we have here in this graph 8 patients treated with a combination of interferon. So we give interferon together, in this case, with a protease inhibitor, VX-950, telaprevir, so whoever knows the new names. So it's a combination of two drugs. And what we see here, as expected, that the first phase decline is very, very rapid. With interferon, I didn't emphasize it before. You could see it on the curves, but maybe I didn't emphasize it enough. With interferon, you have about a decline of a log or two in the first few days, day and a half. With the new drugs, you have 3 or 4 logs decline, which makes total sense. You're blocking directly the enzymes. You're blocking the production. So, of course, it should be the situation. Nobody was too much surprised. What was surprising is the second phase slope is faster than one log, even faster than that, in most patients. In this case, 7 out of 8 patients. Now, why is this surprising? This is surprising because according to the old model I told you, the second phase depends mostly on the loss rate of infected cells. And we have hundreds, thousands of patients that were treated with the standard of care treatment, with the interferon plus ribavirin. We know very well the distribution of that second phase. As I told you, it's a wide distribution between 0 and 1 log, more or less. And then suddenly, with the new drugs, we have more than 1 log in almost all the patients. According to the old model, it means the cells should be lost faster. But that's not the case. We know those drugs are not killing cells faster. And we can actually check, and with virus markers we can see that that's not happening. So what is the situation? Why is the loss rate of infected cells seemingly faster? Why is the second slope faster, and what does it mean for us? So here we have the distribution from many patients in blue here with the standard of care, pegylated plus interferon plus ribavirin, and most of the patients with the new drugs actually are faster than 1.5. We have many more patients here. We have about already, I think, 60 patients or more that we calculated the second slope, and we can see it's much faster. So what's happening here? Since from the beginning, I was really bugged by the fact that we are using those infected cells as a black box. I had a feeling maybe if we start understanding what's happening inside the black box, inside the infected cell, it might help us to understand what's happening with the new direct antivirals, since the direct antivirals are blocking the replication inside the cells. So, of course, the work they're doing is inside the cells. So if we're not modeling it, maybe we're missing some important components. And so we started thinking what we should use as a model for the intracellular dynamics. Now, Harel Dahari, who is now faculty in Chicago, and was my postdoc before, and a postdoc of Alan, published a very nice work for intracellular dynamics, specifically, actually, in vitro, for Hep C. It's very nice work, I must say. It's very nice work. It has about 12 variables. and about 30 parameters, most of them unknown. And the paper itself is trying to understand which parameters are important, which parameters are not, which of the 12 of the terms in these 12 equations is correct and which is not. Because we don't really know yet. As I said, there's no good in vitro system. And working with the best virologist, Charlie Rice is one of the authors and a collaborator on this paper, they're trying to understand what is the model of the in vitro dynamics in the cell. But even with 12 equations and 30 parameters, it's still not clear. All of that aside, no matter if the model is good or not, if we know everything or not, if we have clinical virology data, if we can measure the viral load in the blood, hopefully every 2 or 3 days, and we want to look at the intracellular dynamics in this level of complications, it's never going to work. I mean, unless you know all the parameters, of course, for every patient. You can measure all the parameters for every patient, which is not possible. So this kind of modeling, this kind of level of modeling, is too complicated for what we need. It's not that it's not a good modeling. It's good modeling if your question is, how does in vitro model work? But for doing clinical virology work, this is just not going to work. So instead of that, we are trying to think what we should put in the infected cell. And for that, we need to understand how the viral infection goes in a little more detail. And that's just a little more detail for those of you who know the viral cycle in more detail. So the virus goes in the infected cell. It's an hepatitis C virus. It has a plus strand RNA. The RNA is taken out from the cell, from the virus. And then it goes into what we call a replication complex. And in this replication complex, the plus strand is transcribed into a minus strand. So there's a minus strand made. We are not sure if it works then as a complex, as a double strand, or just the minus strand itself is enough. But anyway, there is a minus strand there. And that replication complex, so I'm calling it replication unit in a more general, generic term, this replication unit is then making more and more plus strands. So in the terms of the model, we have a certain probability, depending on how much genomic RNA you have here, positive RNA here, you have a certain probability make those replication units, the negative strand or double-stranded RNA, and that double-stranded RNA is creating more genomic units. So we have here two variables, one for the replication unit and one for the genomic RNA, RNU. And then as we continue, it's important to realize that in hepatitis C, unlike, let's say, phages, viral bacteria viruses, the virus, as I said before, doesn't kill the cells. One of the things it doesn't do, it doesn't just go and completely fill up the cell. For other reasons, also because it doesn't have enough resources. And what happens is, I'm sorry, I don't see it well enough, but there's a limited amount of replication complexes that can be formed in each cell, which we call here UMAX. And so because of limited resources, you have a limiting factor on the cells, on the replication complexes, and that's what we have here. Basically just a limiting factor. Yes? First, it's not reverse transcription. It's just a polymerase in this case. It's just from minus plus to minus RNA to plus RNA. It's a viral polymerase, yeah. We think it's more protein resource that is the more complicated, because those replication complexes are made for, by the way, very interesting reasons, because they basically, each one of them is a compartment by itself, and you have replication within a small compartment. So it makes the virus replication much more efficient being in a small compartment. So those replication complexes, we need a lot of protein. And so we think that's the most missing resource in this case. So this is two things we are assuming. This is one thing we are assuming in the model, that there is some kind of a limiting resource factor here. And then the other thing we assume, or we know, is that those replication complexes are not static. So once a replication complex is formed, after some time, it gets lost. Now, when I'm saying it gets lost, I'm careful. I don't necessarily mean it gets degraded physically, but it stops being functional. So it doesn't, after some time, it stops making positive RNA. So in other words, we have dynamical replication units, and the loss rate of those replication units is gamma. And remember this gamma, we're going to be talking a lot about this gamma. And then, of course, the RNA, the positive RNA, part of it gets degraded, and part of it gets packed into variants, and those variants are exported, and the loss of RNA that can be used for application we call sigma, and then those RNA are packed and you have an export outside. So that's the biology that we are doing inside the cell. We're going one step further. Remind you the dogs and the sheep. The biology is much more complicated than that, but that's one step further. Yes. Yeah, it's a catalytic process. Basically, you get into a you do get to a steady state of replication units and virus within a cell, and therefore, and afterwards you have just a constant budding out. So if I go now back to the old model, the difference between the old model and the new model, except for the intracellular part, is now the intracellular part. Part of the RNA is packed into viruses and exported outside, and instead of the constant production rate we had before, now we have a variable production rate which is depending on the intracellular dynamics, which we assume after some time comes to a steady state. So that's the difference between the old model and the new model, or this what we call the ICCI model, intracellular cellular level modeling. Okay, great. Exactly. Thank you. So what we're doing here is a Minfield model. So we're doing a Minfield approximation where all the cells behave the same, which is not correct, because a cell that was infected long time ago, of course, as in steady state, is different than a cell that is just infected now. Much more important than that, once we go into the evolution of resistance, I hope I get have time to that, this, of course, is very different from one cell to another. Some cells make resistant virus, some cells make wild-type virus, etc. So the whole thing becomes much more complicated. So here we are using a mean field model. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time, and I didn't plan to, go into stochastic effects and stochastic modeling and age-dependent modeling, but we are continuing this work that I'm not going to show today, also with age-dependent modeling and stochastic modeling to get rid of the mean field part. So what happens with this kind of modeling? Well, if we try now to get how the drug works, as I said, we really have to go into even more complicated, if we want to do a real work, we have to go into one more level of complication, which we actually did, but we're not able to do anything with that. And that also to try to see how much protease and polymerase and other enzymes and proteins that we need are produced in the body and their dynamics. And then, of course, since we have polymerase and protease inhibitors, we could model directly what the drugs do. But trying to do this, I can tell you that at least me and Jeremy got totally lost. So we just came back to one level back, and we said, okay, we can use the drug effect here in three different places. Either the drug affects just the export, it doesn't affect the replication cycle itself, but just the export. We're not actually looking into that, because if you just expect blocking the export, it's just like the old model. If you think about it, there's no difference between this and the old model, because we're not affecting the replication. Or it could block the formation of replication units from the intracellular RNA. But just like the 98 work, we can prove, and I'm not going to show you the proof, but just think of what I showed you before, that if this is the case, you don't get the biphasic decline. It's just like blocking infection. It's exactly parallel to blocking infection. So if we have a biphasic decline, the only way we can get it, a necessary assumption again, is that the drug blocks the production of RNA from positive RNA from the replication unit. Again, it could also block that. We know it also blocks that. But the necessary assumption is that it blocks the production of positive RNA. And then you get the biphasic decline. So what you get then are two possible modes, and here things become interesting. One possible mode, if the drug is not very effective, is that intracellularly, just like before, you're blocking part of the replication, but you're not blocking the replication above the R-naught, above the critical effectiveness, intracellularly, such that you still have a steady state. So you move from one steady state to another, almost steady state. And then what happens is each cell just makes less than what it made before, And when you look at the viral decline in the circulation, you can see that it declines just like before as a function of the rate delta, parallel to the decline of infected cells. And that's basically what's happening in the old standard of care drugs. On the other hand, if your effectiveness is larger than a certain critical effectiveness, then you destabilize the intracellular steady state. Your level of virus in each cell is declining, and basically you are curing the cells. After some time, the cells are going to make no more virus, but anyway, for a time, the virus production is going to go down and down. And in that case, the decline of the virus in the circulation is going to depend anymore not only on delta, but on gamma plus delta. So it's going to depend also on the loss of infected cells, but also on how rapidly you're losing your replication unit, or in other words, how rapidly you're curing the cells. Now, of course, intuitively, it makes very sense. You have loss of infected cells. Just one loss is re-loss of cells, and the other is just loss of infectivity. So gamma is basically just loss of replication inside the cells, and delta is the real loss of the cells. And the viral decline in this case can be much faster because it doesn't depend anymore on delta. So what we see with the new treatment is exactly that. We can calculate what is the critical effectiveness. As I told you, in the new drugs, we actually see that the first phase is larger. So we know the effectiveness is larger, and we can calculate that they do cross the critical effectiveness. And so we are able to get to a much faster decline than we had before. And actually, the implication for that is very important, because it means we can get sustained viral response already after 12 weeks, which was already proven. So if before we needed a whole year to get sustained response, we know that with the new drugs, even 12 weeks, not in all cases, but in a fraction of the patients, is enough to give you eradication of the virus. So we have now two modes, delta mode and gamma mode declines, with the new model that come out from this complex interplay between the intracellular dynamics and the circular or cell level dynamics. And interestingly, the one patient that had a slower second phase was also a patient where the drug was less effective. So in that patient, although he did get the drug was not effective enough, he did not cross the critical effectiveness, and therefore he was in the delta mode, while the other patients were in the gamma mode. I'm going to stop. I'm not going to get into resistance evolution, but just a last slide to kind of summarize things. Why didn't we need this until now? So I'm basically telling you, that's what I hope your understanding is, that in order to understand, in order to work, in order to do any clinical relevant work with hepatitis C with the new drugs, basically for the next generation of treatments, so all the work that we're basically supposed to do from now on, my view is that we have to start working and thinking also from the intracellular level of dynamics. But why we didn't need that until now? We've been working for 10 or 15 years until now, and all of us have been, or many of us have been publishing lots of models. Is everything wrong? I don't think so. I think the difference is, and that's the way we're thinking, maybe because that's my physics background, it's just moving from Newtonian physics to relativistic physics. So basically, at some cases, the Newtonian physics is good until you start going rapid enough. Once you get rapid enough, Newtonian physics doesn't hold anymore. You need relativistic physics. The same thing here. For HIV, you have to remember, what were the assumptions I made here? The assumptions I made here is that there is a maximum number of replication units, and that replication units are lost. But in HIV, and that's why I called it replication units, in HIV, what is the replication in it? It's the integrated DNA, okay? The RNA gets reverse transcribed into a DNA, and the DNA gets integrated. Usually you have only one integrated DNA, although possibly maybe a few, but usually we think there's only one part of the integrated DNA. But it's static. Once the DNA gets integrated in the cell, you cannot get rid of this. It would be great. Actually, there's one treatment now that I've seen that is trying to do this. You cannot get rid of that only by losing the cell. So it's a static replication unit. The moment it's a static replication unit, the intracellular model doesn't mean anything, and the CI model, the cellular level only model, is enough. On hepatitis C, on the other hand, I told you, the replication unit is dynamic. So in principle, we should use the intercellular work. But the old treatment, the interferon-only based treatment, has such a low antiviral effectiveness that it never or almost never crossed the critical effectiveness. And therefore, again, the CI model was good. With the new drugs, where you're moving into relativistic speeds, the effectiveness is much larger, and therefore the old model is not working. So I'm going to end here. There's actually a second part to this work that is the resistance evolution, which also becomes much more interesting. And I'll just give you the end, the last message of the resistance evolution is that even if virus becomes resistant within the cell, even if all the cells are now dominated by resistant virus, you can still eradicate the viral infection with this new model. It's still not proven, it's a prediction, but that's our prediction. That a lot of the patients that are hepatitis C and are eradicated actually eradicating resistant virus already. So thank you very much.